We are on a mission to help lawyers and law firm owners maximize wealth and achieve financial independence. Welcome to The Lawyer Millionaire with Darren Wirtz from Wirtz Financial Services. In this podcast, we will help you build wealth, minimize your taxes, and plan for retirement with money management strategies designed for the legal profession. Join us in this journey where we help you manage your money so you can make the most of your future. Start feeling confident in knowing you are well prepared for retirement and on track to financial independence. Now on to the show.
Have you ever considered that the ethos of your firm or the way you conduct your meetings could be just as critical to your financial prosperity as your prowess in the courtroom? Welcome to The Lawyer Millionaire, where the world of law meets financial acumen, crafting the roadmap to prosperity for law firm owners and seasoned practitioners alike. I'm your host, Darren Wirtz, here to navigate the complex intersection of legal expertise and wealth management with you. Today, we welcome someone truly exceptional in the realms of law and business, Brian Lebovic. Brian's not only a recognized lawyer and entrepreneur, and as I found out today, an actor, he's also an innovator in the legal industry. He has a great track record securing over $400 million for his law clients. As the CEO of Lebovic Law Group, he believes strongly in the importance of having a clear mission, strategic marketing, and corporate culture in legal practice. Brian, it's great to have you here with us today.
It's wonderful to be here, Darren. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, certainly. And I heard you mentioning a little bit of your background before we got started here. I understand you did some boxing earlier in life. I'm curious if you could share with us, what inspired you to enter the field of law?
There's a story that goes with that, right? Like all things that start. I grew up in Dayton, Ohio, for the most part. I went to high school in Dayton, Ohio. I had two very, very close friends. One of them wanted to be in mergers and acquisitions in New York City, a very bright guy. And the other one wanted to be a doctor. And I was caught between those two guys. And I leaned towards science. I leaned toward the doctor. I really like medicine. I like the human body. And so I was on my way to being a doctor. I was taking AP physiology, AP biology, AP chemistry in high school. And we were all doing, you know, relatively well. And I got a traffic ticket. And I went and defended the traffic ticket. And in Ohio, I'm sitting there with my mom and we're getting ready to go into this traffic hearing. And in Florida, you know, there's a million people that walk in. They do these traffic hearings like ad nauseum. But in Ohio with this traffic ticket, I actually had a prosecuting attorney who came over to me and said, hi, it was a young female. I'm whatever my name is. And I'll be the prosecuting attorney and we're going to be doing this for you. And I freaked out. I was like, there's a prosecuting attorney? Like, what's going on here? This is crazy. Like, I don't understand. My mom is like, just relax. I'm like, we got to call a lawyer. Like, call one of your lawyer friends. No, you got to do this yourself. That's the way it is. I went through that process of being my own lawyer in that, right? And the judge kind of instructed me on what to do. I made a lot, like immediately made a lot of mistakes. I tried to interrupt her opening statement. I talked to over people. Like the judge was very instructive on wait. But when the prosecutor called her first witness, which was a police officer, I had a pad of paper and I started writing down questions because he was wrong on the facts of what happened in the accident, which in a traffic accident, it's, you know, invariable that the police will not remember the accident. But I didn't realize that as a kid. And I got up. And I cross-examined this kid, this person, this police officer so well that at the end of it, he was so backwards that he admitted that the sign that was, it was a right turn on red sign, the sign that said no right on red was out of place and that it was hard to see because there was a blocking stop thing in front of it. And so he admitted basically that there was reasonable doubt and I got off, right? When I got done with that process, the judge asked my mom and I to go back into chambers with her. And she sat down and talked to us about what you're going to be. And I said, I'm going to be a doctor. I'm going to go to college. And she goes, my friend, you are not going to be a doctor. You are going to be a lawyer. What you did in there with the cross-examination, your ability to speak in public, your articulation, like everything about you as a high school student was exceptional. You need to be a lawyer.
Wow.
That turned me on to doing this. And I never looked back. I never looked back. And from that moment forward, I wanted to be a lawyer. I wanted to be a trial lawyer. I wanted to be in court. I wanted to you know, do that entire process of convincing six people to go my way. And I was a prosecutor. I wanted to be a prosecutor, but what I really wanted to be.
That is such a great story.
Thank you.
I love that. Yeah, really.
And it's been my whole life. It's been, like, I never have turned away from that my whole life.
Yeah, really, really cool. Well, like you said, you wanted to be a prosecutor. So how did you go from that to starting your own injury law practice? Tell us what happened there.
I was a prosecutor. When I was in law school, I was very active in the moot court mock trial competitions. I pretty much signed up for every single thing. I was on, you know, all of the major trial competitions. I was the even negotiations, like any competition I was into. So I was Order of the Barrister, which there are two people selected for Order of the Barrister in each law school class. So I was one of two. And that got me an interview with the United States Department of Justice. I had also been interviewing with Janet Reno's office. My wife got a job, my, you know, fiance at the time, but got a job with Janet Reno as a prosecutor. I ended up getting an offer in the honors graduate program at the Department of Justice. So I got to get in early with the DOJ and be a prosecutor. And then I was prosecuting criminal aliens for the first couple of years of my practice. And that's how I got to be a prosecutor. And what I found out is that I didn't just love being a prosecutor. There's a lot of, it's a great job. I mean, like, don't get me wrong. It's a great job. And if you want trial experience, it's the best job you'll ever have. PD is also a good job. But honestly, in my opinion, the prosecutor job is the harder job because you have the burden of proof. And when you have the burden of proof, there's a more of an onus that rests on you. When you're the defense lawyer and you can poke holes, you have a lot of, you know, weight on your shoulders because you got a human being that's going to go to jail if you don't do your job well as a criminal defense lawyer, but you don't have as hard a job in the trial. So I started out as a prosecutor. I learned that craft. And then I realized that I needed more independence. I needed more freedom. I was an entrepreneurial person. I've always been an entrepreneurial person. And so what I do now is prosecute civil cases. And I used to call myself, and I trademarked, civil justice prosecutor, because I wanted it to be clear the identity of who we are, that we are fighting for justice. So I consider PI law the same thing as being a criminal prosecutor. We're just civil justice prosecutors.
Yeah, yeah, in many ways, for sure. Very cool. A great transformation there. You know, and so then you went out and you started your practice. How did you go from, you know, that in that moment, just starting out fresh, to today as the CEO of Lobovic Law Group? I mean, that's been an incredible growth journey. How did that transpire?
I'll try to do this quickly because yeah. It was definitely a three phase of my career, right? When I first came out and I started the business, I was a trial lawyer and I was failing up, basically, in my opinion. When you start your practice and you're small, you don't need a lot of cases or a lot of success to be successful. You can make a lot of mistakes. You can make a lot of business mistakes and you think you're successful. And we were successful being poorly run. And that's really what happened, right? I had this great business model, which was trying cases and being an aggressive, you know, person and trying cases for people that would tell people, and then a little bit of advertising. And from 1993 or four, like 1994 until 2008, we shot up and everything was great. The world changed from like 2008 until 2012. Mm-hmm. We went through a really hard period of economic change. In 2008, through hubris on my part, I was overinvested in everything that you could possibly be overinvested in that was bad. I had real estate. I had leveraged the firm. And I thought everything was just going to keep rolling and it was going to be great. And the world came to a stop, but the need to pay that debt load didn't come to a stop. And I didn't have equity where I thought I had equity. And it was hard. I don't know how I avoided bankruptcy, honestly. I think a smart businessman probably would have gone bankrupt. But we fought And it took 5 or 6, 7 years to really get everybody paid off, get everything out of debt, come back into a place that was good. So there was that middle transition period, which was like the caterpillar and the chrysalis and coming out and saying, okay, now I got to be different, you know?
Yeah.
So I came out of that experience realizing that not having any business background was a really bad thing to try to run an organization. And I jumped into education and I tried. And I tried to read every possible business book that was out there. I went to every seminar. I joined every mastermind. There's probably no masterminds that I haven't been a part of in some way, shape, or form. And so I learned a lot. And as I learned, I changed. And as we changed, we grew back slowly. Mm-hmm. And I've got to give credit where credit's due. I've got some great people in my organization who helped me create a leadership structure that allowed us to really grow into a much more significant business system. And now I don't try cases any longer. I only work on the business, not in the business. I have spectacularly good lawyers that work with me that I trust. And I've got great leadership. I've got a CEO, a chief marketing officer, a chief technology officer. I've got a lot of infrastructure. Most firms don't have it. And so I'm doing the field of dream, build it and they will come type thing.
Yeah. And I love that. Okay. So let's unpack this a little bit because there's so much here I want to dive into. I think so many law firm owners are in that middle phase still. Liquidity is really, really tight. They're pushing the margins everywhere they can. They really, really want to grow. Tell us about that transformation. How do you transform from that place where you're like in growth mode, there's very little reserves in the firm's account, in your own account, to getting to a place where, you know, you have that infrastructure now and things are running smoothly and now you can breathe a little bit more easily, right?
So yeah.
How does that come about?
I believe that there is magic in writing down what you are and what you want. The Simon Sinek why concept is really important. And I think that you have to write all of that down. And once you do that, magically, the world changes for you. And so there are things that you need to get clear on, right? The first one is why you're doing what you're doing. Like, what are you doing this for? What drives you? What's the thing that you're trying to do in the world that's good? And you just keep asking why to whatever you're doing. Like, I'm representing injured people. Why? Because I like making money. Why else? Yeah, it makes me feel good that they're doing, like, go back as much as you can and get to your why, right? And say, okay, so that's why you want to do this. Okay. What do you want? What do you want? Like, get down to what you want. I want a firm of 300 lawyers and 700 staff, and I want to be in 52 cities. I'm like, write it down. Be clear about what you want to write down.
Yeah. So the why goes deep. It goes to, you know, personal. Sometimes when I'm asking, you know, clients initially about their why, it's all business. It's all money. It's all business. And it's like, okay, now let's get down to the core of it. Like, for you personally, what kind of life do you want to lead? You know, that's really where it's at.
Yeah.
Tell us about your why.
So, my why, it's interesting. We all come from a place of where we grew up. Like, there's a deep seated thing in our head about what motivates us and drives us, right? I grew up, like I said, in a northern small city in Ohio. I grew up believing and feeling the pressure of being a minority in a community. As a Jewish kid in North Dayton, Ohio, where there was a group of kids in our school whose parents were all in the KKK, there was a real pressure about being Jewish in that school. There was only a few of us, and I grew up feeling like the other in a big way. And we got bullied, and I didn't like being bullied. And I grew up with this hatred of bullies, like just a true hatred of bullies. And I had this experience growing up when my dad made me go out and get in a fist fight, where he was just like, I don't care if you get beat up. I will beat you up worse in here if you don't go outside and fight.
Oh, wow.
So I had this very tough dad, and my dad made me go out and do that. And that changed the course of how I felt about bullies and how to fight back about bullies. And even throughout high school, I had some kids that were not comfortable fighting in high school, and I fought for my friends in high school. Mm. And there was, you know, so that's what I grew up with. And I feel like my dad worked for an insurance company growing up. And he would come home upset because he would have sold somebody a policy that they were relying on, usually a farmer or a plumber. My dad didn't sell high-end insurance. He sold life insurance, and he sold annuities, and he sold financial planning to middle-income folks, normal folks who needed this, you know, for their life to be able to retire and have some financial security.
Mm-hmm.
And what would happen is that he would come home upset because they would have left something off in the policy unintentionally, and his company would be canceling them.
Mm.
And so, you know, Mr. X takes out a policy, and 3 years later or 2 years later, he passes away because of a heart attack. And then the insurance company says, oh, you didn't mention that, you know, like 12 years ago, you had a headache and you were in the hospital, and they said that you might have an aneurysm. Like, there's something in your history that you left out, and they will look for any reason to bully you and not pay you.
Hmm.
And I developed a hatred for those insurance companies for the way that they treated their people, listening to him talk about when he would be frustrated with them. Now, I didn't hear the good stuff. Like, I never heard, like, oh my gosh, Mrs. So-and-so is going to be paid for life because the insurance company paid off. He never mentioned that stuff. So all I heard was the bad stuff. And I really have a deep-seated dislike of insurance companies in my head. So that's why I made the transition from being a prosecutor into being bullying back. I like to bully back the insurance companies. I get a great pleasure out of knowing that I'm taking money from an insurance company and giving it to a human being.
That is deep. I love the. I can tell that you have really spent some time thinking about this and meditating on your own why. And I love that. And I love that it's so specific and it's so real and raw. That's really, really excellent. I want to ask you something else. You know, as this is another personal question, but it's a question that's been burning a hole in my mind recently. And so I want to ask you this. How has building a successful law practice impacted you and your family and your lives? So and the background for this question is, many law firm owners that I speak with struggle with lifestyle creep. As their businesses get more and more successful, they spend more and more money, and as a result, they're still on the struggle bus, like still struggling to find ways to really save money and really even start to build wealth, the kind of wealth that they need in order to have that financial freedom and that time freedom that they really wanted in the first place, in spite of having a multi-million dollar business. So I'm curious, have you experienced this in your own life, either in real terms or in, you know, being tempted to expand your lifestyle that way? Or how has that, you know, shown itself for you, and how have you combated that?
So I did that. I did that whole thing up until 2008 or 9 when things crashed. And I have this very specific recollection that at the end of a year, like right at the end of like 2007, beginning of 2008, when you got the feeling like things were kind of like too high in the market, and you know, like I had gone too far, and I felt like I had pushed a little bit too far. I'd purchased a house. And before I sold a house, thinking, oh, I'll be able to sell that house for a lot of money, no problem, you know. And that house didn't sell. And then we got caught and it like dropped and it was terrible, right? I bought a building, a big 10,000 square foot building, commercial building, thinking that it was going to go gangbusters, and it went right ungangbusters. And I bought, this is the thing that would be, you know, and even though I knew that things were kind of a little bit shaky, I always thought, oh, I'm going to work my way out of it, it's going to be great. Way back then, I bought a Maserati. This is the thing that killed me, right? So I'd buy this Maserati, kind of, and it was because I put it on my vision board, like if I make a certain amount this year, for the firm gross a certain amount, I'm going to get a Maserati. And we made that amount. And I felt like if I didn't get it, I wouldn't be following through on the dream vision of making things happen, or, you know, like, so now I'm obligated. I kind of knew I shouldn't get it, but I got it. So I get this car. It was the worst thing I've ever purchased in my life. Oh. Honest to God. Like, the very first thing that happened is that I drove over, driving it home. It was like maybe the first day or two. I drove over a pothole. The pothole was this deep. I mean, it wasn't big. It blew out the tire, dented the rim. Like, it destroyed the car somehow. I don't know how. But it was like a $3,000 fix on just like going over a pothole. And it was like a stab in the heart. Like, and that car broke. Honest to God, that car broke every 300 miles. And you had to take it into Ferrari to get it fixed because we didn't have a Maserati dealership. So it had to go to Ferrari. The guy at Ferrari, Luigi or Giuseppe or whatever guy that came over from Italy that would fix it, would come out in a spotless white mechanic outfit. Mr. Lebovic, it's a good thing I got it. It's a good thing. You needed an oil change. It's a $3,000. I mean, like, it was like everything was $3,000. It could be like, I looked at your car. It's $3,000. It cost me so much money. And it was like one of these things that said, you deserve this because you knew you shouldn't do it. You knew it was a bad decision. You overspent. And this thing is going to haunt you. And it haunted me for a long time.
Wow.
And I finally, you know, like we, like I said, we crawled our way out of that hole. And when we did it, I swore to myself, I wasn't going back into that hell where the tail wags the dog. And so there was a lot of steps. I mean, there's a lot that goes into building business. And if people are listening, like, what are my first steps? Your first steps are find your vision, find your why and who you are and what you want to be. Get a mission. Know what your mission is. Make it clear. Know what you want your mission to be. Our mission is to maximize justice by aggressively fighting for our clients' rights. Like, there's no human being on my team that won't say it that fast, that easily. We start every single meeting with it.
Yeah.
And then you need to know your core values. Like, get to who you are, know what you want to do, and then behave within those core values. So we have four core values that are very clear: fight to win, passion to serve, relentless innovation, and own it. And when people buck us, I can almost invariably tie it to one of those core values that they are not exhibiting, right? And that makes it easy to teach your team how to do things. So that's kind of behaviorally getting everybody moving on the bus in the same direction. And then you've got to get really good on your numbers, which I didn't realize before. I had no concept that a balance sheet and a profit and loss had any meaning at all beyond how is it red or how is it black? And that was it. I looked at two numbers. I had none of that. And if you want a good book that really gets to the heart of that, it's called Simple Numbers, Straight Talk, Big Profits by Greg Crabtree. And that small, I've read a gazillion books on money and finance and good, great, and culture, as well as business systems. There's great books out there, great books. Vern Hardish's Scaling Up is great. Gino Wickman's EOS is great. I'm like, there's a lot of great books out there. But this particular thin analysis of how to run a business on the numbers was the first thing that like hit me over the head hard and said, you can do this if you follow this plan. And when we got clear on that and I started cutting things out that were unnecessary, we started to get clear on what we were going to spend our money on. We got everybody clear on the mission. We got out of 100% of our debt. Like, we got down to zero debt. And now we accumulate debt strategically, depending on what we're doing, in a very clear, very organized business plan where no one's stepping out of line to chase a shiny object over a hill, which is my biggest problem, right? Like, I'm always wanting to chase a shiny object. I'm the dog in squirrel there, you know.
Yeah, wow. So how, I mean, that was a great story, by the way. I really appreciate you sharing that with us, in what you learned in 2008 and going through all that, the whole experience, especially with your car. How do you maintain that balance? You know, there are things on our vision board we want to achieve. We feel like we should have them. But how do you strike the balance, and how do you make sure that you are staying where you should? you know what I mean? And not extending yourself too far. What's been the secret for you?
Being consensus and relying on other good people to keep kind of the vision of where we're going in check, right? So 5 years ago, I came out with a very clear vision of where I wanted the firm to go. To get people there, I detailed out every year, like every year, what we would do each year to get to that vision. And because I could do that, because I had that for them, they could envision it with me. Because until I did that, I could say, oh, we're going to be $25 billion firm in 5 years. Let's go do it, right? You can say that, right? But then one person runs this direction, one person's running that direction. You're saying charge, and everybody's going their own way, right? But if you say, okay, here's the plan, this is what we're going to do, this is what we're going to do, you guys agree to that, and you get consensus, and then you say, okay, let's detail out how we're going to do it. Like everybody's role, everybody's job, everybody's thing. And what you said at the beginning of this, right? What you said at the beginning of this was so important, because once you do all of this big vision, kind of high level, 300,000 feet above the world, looking down vision stuff, you need to be able to execute it. And that's meetings. And, you know, people say, oh, meetings, how many meetings do you need? If you don't have great meetings, you aren't going anywhere. Like, you can have all the vision you want in the world, but you're not going to keep people moving forward in a way that's productive. And we continue to push the efficiency of those meeting structures in the firm to continue to push forward progress. And as you get better at meetings, and as you get more organized with meetings, and as people learn their role in the meetings and what's going to happen after the meetings, as you create accountability systems from the meetings so that in the next meeting, you're accountable to fix what was done in the previous meeting, you get that forward flow. I mean, the concept of running meetings is what makes things go forward. So create a team that you trust, have a vision, have them rein it in so that you know where you're going, get good direction, and then plan it out and have the meetings to make that action happen. That's the secret.
So what are, yeah, tell us about the meetings. What are some of those key aspects that people could implement right away that make meetings more successful?
So you need to pick a system, and you need to read and learn the system. There's like 10 systems out there on meetings, but the one that we use that worked for us is the EOS system. I find it to be a really good moderate meeting amount or systems. It's not as many as Vern Harnish's. It's not as few as Cameron Harold's, but you know, it's like, it's this middle ground of very efficient reading. So you can read a book called Traction by Gino Wickman, or a book called Get a Grip by Gino Wickman, which is kind of the Pat Lincioni allegory tale of how things come true in the system, right? You can read The Advantage by Pat Lincioni. That's another meeting system that'll give you really good structure. But our meetings are built on that EOS system. So the key for us right now are two systems of meetings. So I'll just tell you my meetings, all of our meetings, our meeting cadence, because that'll probably be.
Okay, yeah.
So biggest meeting is every year we have an annual all hands on deck meeting. We bring everybody in from around the United States. You know, we've got, you know, almost 80 or 90 people. We had a little over 100 people, but we thinned down. So now we're like 97 people. Brought them all in, sat them all down, and told them what the next year is going to be about, and got everybody on board. So that's a one time a year big meeting. We have quarterly leadership meeting. So quarterly, the leadership team goes offsite to plan big things and make sure that that quarter's goals, which we call rocks, that the quarter's goals are clear, right? Because we've gained in size, we have a second day, all day off staff, all offsite for mid-level management. We call it mid-level management. So we have the leadership meeting, then we have the mid-level management meeting, which we have all of our directors of all the divisions in the firm come in. If you're managing people, you're in that meeting. It's a big meeting, and we tell them, this is what we did yesterday. You guys are going to help execute this plan. Let's all get everybody on board. This is what we're going to do in the next quarter. Let's talk about it. We also have them do a book club. So everybody reads a book a quarter. Leadership reads a book. Management reads a book. Usually they fall down so that leadership will read it. Then management will read it. And then we can talk about it. And everybody keeps moving forward in the management education system. So that's big picture. Then we have weekly meetings. Our weekly meetings are, the first one is our leadership meeting. We have what we call a tactical meeting, and that's an EOS-derived level 10 meeting. So we go through a very clear analysis on that meeting. The structure is every year we do identity. Like I said, every meeting starts with vision of who we are, mission statement. We all say it together, core values. Then we move to Elizabeth now, the CEO, runs these meetings. So we do KPIs. So we have our KPIs. We see who's doing KPIs. We look at quarterly rocks, who's on track for their quarterly rocks. Anything that's wrong in those first two areas falls down into issues and to-do. So then we have a to-do. Last week, you were supposed to do this. Did you get it done? If you didn't, why not? Are we going to keep it on? Are we moving it off? Is it a bigger issue? And then bigger issues drop to the bottom. It's a 1 hour and 30 minute meeting. You grade every meeting, what, 0 to 10. You want your meetings to be 9 or 10s, right, at the end. And if you're not getting there, then you got to figure out why we're not. So that's how we move those issues forward. And then leaders all have weekly one-on-ones with their direct supervisors. So everybody, if you lead a person, you're going to have a one-on-one with that person once a week. And if you are led by a person, you will have, and so you might have two one-on-ones, one where you're a subordinate, one where you're a superior. And that makes sure everybody's on board, staying happy in the firm. What we don't do particularly well is a daily huddle. That's something that I think is really important for teams to do. I like the teams to have that daily huddle just to get your group together, at least your small group, whoever you lead, and every day say, okay, guys, good morning. How is everybody? How y'all checking in? We've got a lot to do today. This is what we're headed. You know, Joanne, you're doing this right. Andy, you're doing that. I'm going to do this. All right. We'll talk at the end of the day. Talk to you later. Just keep communication flowing. That's our meeting cadence.
Okay. So. That's great. A lot of people hate meetings. So, and I think they hate them because there's no structure and there's no system. So I think that what you outlined there is a much better approach for sure.
I think they hate them because they don't have trust.
I think
that when you're with a bunch of people and you're afraid to speak your mind or you think something or you don't like the person next to you, it makes meetings foolish and like no one wants to say the truth. No one wants to have the fight. You know,
it's unproductive. Yeah.
And then you have the meeting after the meeting in the bathroom.
Yeah.
Then three men go into the bathroom and they're peeing and they're like, I'm not doing this. Are you doing this? Nah, I'm not doing this. Right. Like, or three girls are in the bathroom and they're talking about whatever.
Well, that's great. I feel like we have a whole conversation on all of that, but that's some really great insight there. Brian, unfortunately, we kind of come to the end of our time here. It's been great having you. I would ask you about your millionaire mission, but I think you already outlined that for us, which is great. You know, your core vision there. But in closing, would you please share with us a little bit about some of the other stuff, some of the other work that you do? You have some books out, and then tell our audience how they can learn more about you.
Okay. You can learn about me at my name, Brian Lebovic. If you type that into Google, you'll come up with everything that I pretty much do. We have two foundations that we run. One is called Safety for Life, where we teach high school kids about safety items that are very important: human trafficking, police interaction, traffic safety, and internet safety. That's the mission of Safety for Life. We also have, through my wife, a Cuban female attorney, runs a foundation called Hispanos Unidos in Palm Beach County, where we take all the siloed Hispanic communities, the Puerto Ricans, the Argentinians, the Cubans, and we all put them into social structure so that the businesses can all get together and learn about each other and grow the Hispanic community. So those are two of the fun, cool things that we do. We're very involved in the PACE Center for Girls also. If you want to know about that, look up PACE Center for Girls. We're out in the community. One of our things is passion to serve, and that's serving our clients, but also serving the community. So we talk a lot about that in the firm. I wrote a book. It's called Not a Good Neighbor, because I don't like any of the Allstate or State Farm people. I was going to call it Snake Farm, but I thought that was too aggressive. And it's about how to settle your own PI case, so that if you don't want to hire a lawyer, or you have a small case that was like, I can't help you, we give that book to our clients. You can buy the book on Amazon. It's in Spanish and English. And it's on audiobook if you need it. And it'll teach you how to do your own personal injury case, because not everybody wants to hire a lawyer.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been great talking with you and hearing your ideas.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. This is a lot of fun. And, you know, good psychotherapy got right in my head.
Absolutely. All right. And thank you to our listeners for joining us today. We hope that this episode has offered you knowledge and strategies that you can implement in your own practices. If you found this conversation enlightening, please consider subscribing to our podcast and leaving a review. Your feedback not only supports us, but helps other professionals like yourselves find us. Finally, for those of you who are ready to take a closer look at your financial future, I invite you to visit our website and book a call with me, Darren Wirtz, at thelawyermillionaire.com. We're committed to not only addressing your immediate financial questions, but also helping you lay a steadfast foundation for your ongoing financial journey. Together, we can work to ensure your financial strategy aligns seamlessly with your professional goals. Until next time, keep advocating, keep growing, and remember, here at The Lawyer Millionaire, we're more than just a podcast. We're your partner in building a financially secure future.
Thank you for listening to The Lawyer Millionaire. Click the follow button below to be notified when new episodes become available. This content has been made available for informational and educational purposes only. This content is not intended to represent investing or tax advice. Always seek the advice of a qualified investment or tax advisor with any questions you may have regarding your own financial circumstances.